Welcome to A Life in Biography. I'm calling this episode The Existential Loneliness of a Long-Distance Biographer. I couldn't think of a more pretentious title. That's as good as I could manage. The existential part I will get to in due course. As I said on an earlier podcast, these are kind of stream of consciousness podcasts. I have a message, a theme. I sometimes get to it in a rather roundabout way. I want you to imagine it. The podcast really is one biographer talking to another, or a biographer talking to a group of biographers, not like a conference presentation, but simply as if we were just sitting together talking. And when we do that, we digress. We get off point sometimes, but we come back to the point in our conversations, which is what I will hope to do today. This podcast was really stimulated, provoked, by a biographer who wrote to me, who was feeling, and she'll use this phrase in one of her emails that I will read, in the dark. I also, and I'm simply characterizing her feelings. She's a first-time biographer. I think she was lonely. And for her, it was a kind of existential experience. There's something, and I don't think I've talked about this before, written about it before. There is something lonely, isolating about doing a biography, even if you're part of a biographer's group, say, or you belong to the Biographers International Organization or some such thing. And it's different from writing history in that with a biography, obviously, it's personal, it's individual. And no one really would say to you, if you were writing a history, how presumptuous to think you could write about so many events or an event, the French Revolution or whatever. Historians do it all the time. Biographers do it all the time too with their subjects. And yet, as Boswell said, a few hundred years ago, biography is viewed as a kind of presumptuous task. And when you look at biography that way, the onus is on you. You're to blame for doing this person, whether they're alive or dead, in a sense. And if there are family members or friends, look out. They might be cooperative. I've had some good success with families and friends of my subjects. And in some cases where I knew my subjects, either alive or dead, would not have had anything to do with me, I don't attempt to befriend people. I try to get to as many people as possible to interview them, but I don't. I don't try to pretend to be anyone's friend in that sense. And that is, again, in a way, isolating. Makes you lonelier than you would otherwise be. So here's the first email from this first-time biographer. I'm not going to mention her name. And I'm not going to mention her subject. I've already told you her, so you know it's a woman. The subject is a Hollywood figure, I'll say that much. But I won't identify the biographer or the subject specifically. And the biographer who contacted me knows, she knows, that I was going to make this the subject of a podcast and was fine with it. So the first email sent to me, and the other thing I'm doing with this podcast is sort of recreating the email chain, the back and forth between biographers that can go on, that has gone on between me and many biographers over many, many years. So the first email is dated Thursday, March 21st at 10:16 a.m. I will, for all sorts of reasons, not read all of an email, but I'll read the parts that are relevant to the topic of discussion. So she begins, "Hi, Carl. I'm working on my biography and learning how to do it as I go. It can be overwhelming, but I keep moving. It really is fascinating to search through all of this, and it's amazing for me to see how my subject story is also the story of America. I would like to try to get in contact with my subject's family members. It's kind of tough to figure out who is still alive. I know that his niece," she gives the name, "gave a lot of interviews in the 1990s, but she may not even be alive anymore. Then there are family members who still may have the original family name. Her subject changed his name for the movies. She knows of one of her subject's relatives who's alive. I may have found her Instagram and Facebook page. But of course, I'm trying to figure out whether that's really her. There are so many fakes out there. Anyway, I'm not sure how to go about this. I am wondering how to even start my conversation with his granddaughter. I would like her to be part of the project, but of course, I am writing the biography, so I would have to have full freedom to write it." One of the obvious problems you often have. I'll digress for a moment. That is, I'll address this point before reading any more of the email. And that is, what I've tried to do is, in contacting people, is to, in any way I can think of, to make them part of the process, to make them realize I'm not just trying to get information out of them, although, of course, I'm doing that. But that we're part of the same thing. And if that works, that means even after the biography is published, I still hear from these people, which I do in many cases. In my experience anyway, over more than 40 years, the people who would be trouble are the people who don't want to talk to me at all. But I've got a shot with almost anybody who will at least answer a letter or talk to me on the phone or in any way engage with me and the biography. She goes on to say, "I realize I have to tread carefully here. I want to make sure that her subject's dignity is preserved, while obviously using all of the research and being factual about everything." And those of you who are experienced biographers know that even when you're factual, or believe you're factual at everything, that doesn't mean that you won't face animosity. People who don't want to believe the facts, or have a different version of the facts, and because they have a different version, they contest not your version, but the idea that you have the facts at all. So that was Thursday, March 21st at 10:16 a.m. Okay, the same day, Thursday, March 21st, that was at, she wrote at 10:16 a.m. I answered her at 10:54 a.m. And I say to her, after a few pleasantries, what you are experiencing is what so many biographers encounter. Who is alive? Who will talk? How to approach them? How to keep control of the story, and so on. As far as the family goes, have you tried to trace any of them through Ancestry.com? I'm just giving, you know, the obvious answer here. What about biographies of others who were close to or had dealings with your subject? If you haven't already done so, look at biographies of his contemporaries in Hollywood. Check the acknowledgement sections of those books to see who the biographer relied on. And write to some of those biographers. I think this is often something you don't do. I have written to biographers who have done my subject before. And in most cases, they haven't been territorial. They've been very generous and provided me with leads. So write to some of those biographers who may have helpful suggestions on where to look or who to approach. Is there an oral history of your subject, either at the Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences or in the Oral History Archive in Butler Library at Columbia? For example, there was a really interesting, good oral history interview with Walter Brennan. And it was at Butler Library, Columbia University, nowhere else, not at the Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences. So there are all sorts of places where you may find accounts of your subject. And then I say to her, I might very well make your concerns the subject of a podcast. So here we are. I won't use your name or mention your subject, but rather just deal with the questions and concerns you raise. Okay, so that was the same day. Less than half an hour after I got the email, I answered it on the 21st. Okay, she writes back the same day, Thursday, March 21st, that's of this year, at 2:06 p.m. And this is what really sort of got me started on this podcast. She says, "Thank you so much, Carl. It's good to hear all this. I feel sometimes alone and in the dark." That's a feeling that many biographers cannot shake off. It's a feeling that many people don't want to have, and that's why they don't do biography. And it's a feeling, if you're like me, that you've dealt with for decades. She goes on to say, "This is such a strange journey, but beautiful too. I have a good day of getting research like yesterday. I got in touch with the University of Pennsylvania and the Smithsonian Institution. Found some stuff on her subject. About to read a phrase, but I better not, because it might more closely identify why she was dealing with the Smithsonian. But she goes on to say, "But then I feel overwhelmed again. It's all so new to me." Remember, she is a first-time biographer. "And although I've done many biographies, there are days when I feel some anxiety and feel overwhelmed. But like her, I keep moving." She says, "I haven't looked through other biographies yet, but I was planning, especially those actors that worked with her subject. Given the fact that I'm new at this, I didn't think too much about oral histories, but obviously it's very important. I haven't checked Columbia, so I'll do that for sure. I watched there's an A&E biography on her subject, and they interviewed some family members and friends. Norman Lloyd, in particular, had some interesting things to say." Norman Lloyd recently died. I think he was 104 when he died. I interviewed him for my Dana Andrews biography. He was just a wealth of information and so encouraging and so generous. So I'm not surprised to hear that she got something out of Norman Lloyd. And she goes on to say, "I can't wait to hear your podcast." Well, she will hear it very soon. So that's Thursday, same day, her second email at 2:06 p.m. Same day, March 21st, at 5:10 p.m., that's 3 hours later, I answer her. And I say, "Lonely. I hadn't thought about it in a long time, but you are right. Perhaps I'll call the podcast The Existential Loneliness of the Long Distance Biographer." And I go on to say to her, "Existential might seem like overkill, but I know of at least one biographer who confessed to suicidal feelings." A very fine biographer who confessed to these feelings. A very prolific writer, very good writer. And she had suicidal feelings, but she wasn't close to suicide. I don't mean to imply that. But what she actually said to me was that she was sort of telling me this in confidence, one biographer to another. She said, "You know, after you're in some strange town or university and you spent all day in the archive and you have to go back to a hotel room, don't you just feel like slitting your throat?" And actually, I have felt like that. And the reason I felt like that is because you just, I shouldn't say you, I'll just speak for myself. I feel so emptied out. I've been so fully absorbed and so concentrated in that archive not wanting to waste a minute. And the feelings are so intense, maybe because of what I'm reading in the archive, but maybe just because I'm there and I know my time is limited. I'm not one of those biographers with the resources where I can just park myself somewhere and spend weeks and weeks reading through an archive. I have to go back and forth, back and forth, back and forth. On short trips, when I was teaching, I often got travel funding. Now I don't travel, so that's not an issue. But I certainly understand this idea of aloneness, of loneliness. I mentioned to her in this same email other sources like newspapers.com, which I used extensively in my biography of Ronald Coleman, which I've just published. You do have to pay a subscription, I tell her, but it's worth it. I think it is. Besides getting a lot of reviews, you might get some other leads and connections worth pursuing. That's been my experience anyway. And then I say, and this is my last paragraph of this email, when you say you are new at this, I have to say that every time I start a biography, it seems like the first time. Of course I have experience to rely on, but all the questions you raise get asked every time I do another biography. And that's true. Even when, in a sense, the biographies overlap. When I did Marilyn Monroe, my first biography, I got to know people in Hollywood who were helpful with my Lillian Hellman biography because of her screenwriting. Some of them knew her, or they knew people who knew her. So that certainly helps when you're a serial biographer like me. There is some overlap. Or if you're a biographer like Ray Boomhauer, for example, who deals with one journalist after another, and they're all more or less focused on World War II and the post-World War II era, that also gives you a kind of cushion, connections, and so on. Even so, even with all that stuff, for me anyway, there's always a kind of first-time feeling to doing a biography. So that was my reply on March 21st at 5:10 p.m. We're not done with March 21st. She writes back. I wrote her at 5:10 p.m. She writes back at 5:24. Now, one of the things is perhaps obvious in this email chain is both of us feel some urgency, some anxiety about all this and what we should do about it. You know, it's like calling up a friend and, you know, telling them your troubles and what can you do about it? And you call somebody who you think might have some ideas. She says, that's funny about suicidal feelings. I mean, funny in a weird way, obviously. Ha ha. She goes on to say, working on this feels great. But also there's a sense of responsibility, which can be very heavy. I certainly take this task very seriously. I'm finding it addictive, too. I'm finding strands I didn't even know existed. It is exciting and exhilarating, but also daunting. You have this sense of responsibility. When you're writing about history, the French Revolution, you don't have any responsibility. You don't feel any, I don't think, any responsibility to Robespierre or Danton. But when you're dealing with your own biographical subject, it's very different. She goes on to say, I'm really looking forward to hearing your thoughts on the podcast about this. Well, here you are. And I do like the title. I think writing is a metaphysical experience, so I think it's totally appropriate. She says these conversations are so helpful and reassuring. And she says that on March 21st at 5:24 p.m. I respond to her the same day at 5:54 p.m., about 20 minutes or so later. And I just say, biography is addictive, obsessive. Once I got started on biography, I was never able to stop. Still can't. And I'm 76. I guess I'm a hopeless case. Well, we're not done with March 21st. she goes on, this is at 5:58 p.m., so this is just 4 minutes later from my response to her previous email. 4 minutes later, she says, yes, there is a responsibility to the subject, but to me, oh, I'm sorry, this is my response. On Thursday, March 21st at 5:50 a.m. I'm agreeing with her. Yes, there is a responsibility to the subject, but I can't leave it at that. I say, to me, there is an even greater responsibility to biography itself. Many critics, family members, all sorts of people may try to make biography seem illegitimate, although the favored term for that illegitimacy is unauthorized. The word makes no sense. Who could authorize you to write history? No one. Same with biography. And yet biography is treated differently from history, and that is wrong. That's my statement. She goes on, she responds at 6:23 p.m. on March 21st. This is about a half hour later. When I say, same with biography, and yet biography is treated differently from history, and that is wrong. She says, that's true. I never thought of it that way. I think that's true of a lot of biographers. They don't think of it that way, and I think they should. In terms of history versus biography, I think others want to own the person in some sense because they know the person in the flesh, as if anyone can know someone's interiority completely. Recently, someone told me about a very famous writer whose friends saying they didn't want to deal with the biographer because they didn't know him, and they were waiting for someone who they felt was really responsible to do it. They didn't know that the person doing it was irresponsible. They simply didn't know him. And to me, that's just all wrong when people talk about it that way. You engage with the biographer and figure out what the biographer's about and whether you want to cooperate with the biographer or not. But this idea that somehow they have to pass your judgments, your biographer's test, I just find repugnant. I really hate that. Those people don't own their subject no matter how well they think they knew him. So that's March 21st at 6:23 p.m. You think we're done on March 21st? We're not. Thursday, March 21st at 8:38 p.m., a couple hours later, I say, I'm picking up on her idea of the biographer can't know the interiority, the interior of the subject. I say, on Thursday, March 21st at 8:38 p.m., when someone says a biographer cannot get inside a subject, well, okay. But does the subject know himself or herself as others, including the biographer, know that person? I've said this many times. There's no 100%. You know, when people knock biography, they say, well, how can you know? How can anybody know? We do the best we can with the information we have, which is often more than you can get from anybody who knows the subject when you look at the totality of the subject. At 9:02 p.m. on March 21st, she says, I mean to say that it's impossible to know someone or ourselves in a completely certain manner. We can be walking contradictions. But on the other hand, maybe it's a biographer's distance that illuminates the subject, something the subject himself cannot do simply because he's living it. Well, I think that's one of the great rationales for biography and what makes biography different from autobiography. Well, that was all on March 21st. We break for a week, and I break for a sip of coffee. Now we're at March 27th, 6 days later, at 2:36 p.m. Just a couple more emails here. Dear Carl, the last few days have yielded a lot of research on my subject. There are so many places and libraries that contain things related to him. and I feel heartened that every time I do a little bit of research, something new comes out. Another little piece of information I did not have, another small thread. I have a question for you in regards to how to deal with sources. There is a biography called, and I'm not going to title the biography because it'll tell you who the subject is. It was published in 1983 and then republished in 2004. She describes this biography of her subject as a bit sketchy, if you ask me. In any case, there are no citations at all in this book. There is a mention of some archives, but chapters have neither the footnotes nor the sources at the end of the book, pointing to different lines or paragraphs and chapters, so there is no way of knowing where any of this stuff comes from. According to the author, he interviewed a lot of people who knew and worked with her subject. All of those people are long dead, so there is no way to check anything. I'm going to stop there for a minute. There is sometimes a way to check things, because sometimes you get these anecdotes that you find in biographies, and if you've got a time and a place, you can sometimes figure out that it couldn't have happened, that so-and-so wasn't in there, couldn't have been in that time and place or done those things. That's occurred to me many times with Marilyn Monroe, some with Ronald Coleman. With Faulkner it happened, where someone wrote me an email talking about his friend being at Faulkner's funeral, and then this friend supplied some details, and I wrote back and I said, it's just all wrong. It just couldn't have happened the way this person said. There are just too many other sources to contradict this. So the more you know about your subject, the more you go through sources, you begin to weed out what really isn't valuable. Can't weed it all out. You may pass on some things which are not true or not true as you got them from your sources. It's very difficult to write a biography without passing on some of those errors. That's why one biography, I'm going to sound like a broken record, one biography is an answer to another biography. It's why we get so many biographies of the same figures going over the same ground, because there are things people miss, even though it's the same ground. She says, in terms of this book that doesn't give attribution sources, would you include something like that in a biography, perhaps with a disclaimer? And sometimes people do that. One of the ways, I'll give you my response and see if I want to add to it. So I respond. She wrote on March 27th at 2:36 p.m. I responded Wednesday, March 27th at 2:47 p.m., so about 10 minutes later. I said, I think you can identify who was interviewed and what they say. I think where you can identify who was interviewed and what they say, you can say according to, that's one possibility, which sort of leaves you off the hook, although it's not entirely satisfying. Some of what this book purports to tell you, that is, I'm referring to the book she mentioned that didn't have its sources, its notes. Some of what this book purports to tell you may be able to verify or reject by the end of your research. That's what I was just saying. You get this cumulative experience in doing a biography, and it does help you weed through the good, the bad, and the ugly. Also, I say, in a sources section, you can make some comments on the veracity of sources and what might be problematic. In other words, the whole history of how your subject has been written about. I did that in my first biography of Sylvia Plath. The very last chapter was all about the development of Plath biography and why we know things, certain things, and why we don't know other things and what there's still to be learned. Part of what you may accept will, in the end, comport with your sense of what your subject was like or likely to have said. And I say, you might find my Ronald Coleman biography instructive, since I deal with precisely the questions you are asking and often comment on my sources and my footnotes. I want to say one more thing about that. Not only do I comment on my sources in my footnotes, but those footnotes are actually footnotes. In my Ronald Coleman biography, it's the only biography I have done where I said to the publisher, I really want the notes not to be at the end of the book, but to be at the bottom of the page, because I consider what I write as narrative to be in dialogue with my sources, and therefore I want to see the sources. The downside, of course, is people can find this distracting, the going back and forth. But most people do want to know where the biographer got this stuff. And yes, you can turn to the endnotes, but that's kind of a chore. Sometimes I read through the endnotes separately, almost as if they were another book, and then measure those endnotes against what I wrote in the narrative. So I'm having the biographer, the reader of the biography, do that on the page, so to speak. And I just decided anyone who is that interested in Ronald Coleman would be interested in where I got that stuff. There's some very familiar stories about Ronald Coleman that are wrong, just not true. And I show why they're not true, usually in the footnotes, not in the narrative, because that could get tiresome. And therefore, people do have that option of skipping the footnotes if they want, but I think it's going to be difficult with it right there on the page, which is fine with me. At any rate, there may be no ideal solution to showing readers what you know and how you know it. But for me, anyway, it makes me a little less lonely. Thanks for listening.